working for an entrepreneur, it's not rocket science. You don't need an MBA, you don't need a PhD or anything like that. There are simple, immutable facts. Cash is king.
Hello and welcome to V for Visionaries podcast with me, Richard Ward. I am an award-winning serial entrepreneur with over 35 years experience in the beauty and media world. And I've built and sold many businesses. But today I'm most interested in finding out who are the movers and shakers in business, what makes them so successful, and why certain cream rises to the top.
And me, Rosamund Stenhouse. I am an award-winning fourth generation of entrepreneurs. I have spent several decades working with all aspects of land, delivering new towns and large-scale landmass for development. I now work with national and international entrepreneurs, scaling, improving sales, and expanding their business. This is the podcast where bold ideas meet business brilliance.
Yes, and each week we'll be sitting down with trailblazing entrepreneurs and industry leaders to uncover the strategies, the stories, and the secrets behind some of the world's most exciting business ventures.
So today we have the pleasure of interviewing Edward Parsons, a CFO that took a company from 120 million turnover to a 2 billion turnover in just 7 years. So welcome, without further ado, to V for Visionaries, Edward Parsons.
Edward, thank you so much for joining us. We so appreciate you being here.
Oh, Richard, Roz, thank you very much indeed. I'm very excited to be here.
Oh, lovely.
So what we like to do on this podcast, we like to take you all the way back. Just before you got to, way before you got 30 years ago, more than that, to this heady, holistic height that you have achieved. But let's go back to your humble beginnings. And can I just ask you, where did you grow up? What kind of background do you come from? Is it a finance background? I'll just let you take it from there.
Well, gosh. Well, so I grew up on in a small Kentish town on the coast, a little place called Folkestone. When I was about 10, we moved down the road to an even smaller place called Hythe, a very old seaside town on the Kent coast. And I was there until I was 18 and I went to university. My father owned a small building company in Folkestone, a family building company that had been going for 150 years. And my mother was a teacher. So quite humble background in a small part of the world.
So Ed, I just want to pick up on that for a second. Did you just say your father had a family business that had been in the family business for 150 years?
Yeah, that's right. That's insane. A small local building company. Unfortunately, the company failed during the 93 recession, which I think was my father felt incredibly guilty about and found psychologically quite hard. You know, he had this weight of the family on top of him. And in its heyday, the company, as I understand it, was a sizable concern and was very much involved in building out Folkestone in the late 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, that period of time when there was a huge amount of development. There's an awful lot of Victorian building stock as you drive around Folkestone. So,
wow, so you come from a long line of entrepreneurs. So you're third generation, effectively. I mean, you haven't taken that road, but you have a strong entrepreneurial background within your family.
I guess I've never really thought about it like that. I mean, now you pointed out that's bleedingly obvious. Though I wouldn't describe my father as an entrepreneur. He wasn't a risk taker.
Right.
Right. And he certainly wouldn't have what I would consider an entrepreneurial profile, having worked for entrepreneurs for the last 25 years.
Right.
Right. He wouldn't fit within that mold at all.
Do you think that's of its time, though? Do you think that was men of their day then as entrepreneurs? You're comparing the kind of entrepreneurs that you work with and today, or do you think
I think society's fundamentally changed, because yes. I suspect what you find, lots of the entrepreneurs were the landed gentry and the upper classes, right? Because they had all the capital. So,
but your father's inherited third generation, isn't he? So he inherited that company, took over from his father.
Yes, correct.
Yeah, so maybe within a family, I mean, they've only got so many children. One of them has to fit the bill. So maybe your father was picked because he had a good business. I mean, your grandfather would have picked him for the solid reasons that he would have been presented. But maybe, yes, your father might not have ever been able to originate a business, but he certainly was able to run one by the sounds of things.
Yes, though, you know, the building trade is a hard trade. You know, it's like, it's all about detail, right?
Yeah.
Fine margins. And so I think it was definitely hard yards for him.
So what did you learn from him?
Value sets. So loyalty, integrity, honesty, hard work, applying yourself. So I think those are the things that I really look back. My father wasn't a demonstrative person. He was a product of his time, you know, pre-war. He was born into war, 1930. He was born into a sort of late Edwardian sort of era, and he was he arrived in a time when, you know, children were seen, not heard. You know,
yes.
He was very much that.
Yes.
He was a very introverted man. I mean, diametrically opposite to me. So in many respects, we were chalk and cheese, but I respected him hugely.
Yes, yes. That I was just going to pick up on that. What a wonderful set of values. Okay, so he was an entrepreneur. Let me ask you, was he a figures man? Did he know what he was doing in business? Did he know what a bottom line was?
He was a numbers man because he was a quantity surveyor by background and training, but he wasn't a businessman.
Right.
Okay. Running a business, I think, was not something that he was adept at.
Right. He was probably horrified taking it over them. He was probably horrified.
Yeah, I think it was a real struggle for him in an industry that was a struggle.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm sure. So just fast forwarding, so let's take you, so you're born in Folkestone. What kind of education did you have? Were you a grammar school boy or did you have a primary education?
I was both state and private, so I went to the local primary school and I was whisked off to a prep school. And I think that was very much about my parents, A, wanting to give me as good an opportunity, a start in life as possible, as well as maybe a certain element of keeping up with the Joneses. Because a lot of people in their social set, well, they were sending their children to the local prep school. And then I was supposed to get a scholarship to go to the public school in Kent, which is King's Canterbury.
Yes.
Kind of regard, but I failed that. But I got into the Dover Grammar School and I went there. And the catchment area for that school was mostly East Kent, and lots of young people from mining villages in East Kent that don't really exist any longer because that industry's gone. Yeah. And a lot of them had real life challenges. And it was a difficult assimilation. I was the posh kid that came from a prep school in Folkestone, you know, the next town over, going to Dover with a whole load of kids that were coming from grit and mining villages in East Kent. And that was a life education.
Yeah.
So did you always know, I mean, look, let's cut to the chase. You're clearly a very bright man. Were you always aware that you had a good bit of brain matter up top for figures?
Educationally, things didn't start to click until I was in the into the sixth form.
Oh, really?
I would say I was a very, very average student as an O-level student, now called GCSEs. But yeah, I was very average and probably only just borderline for whatever reason at the grammar school. But as soon as I got into the sixth form, and I think it was really because the people I was around in the classes, because they were highly disruptive, a lot of them, I guess because of some of the challenges, personal challenges they had. And when I went to the sixth form and people were interested in studying and I was able to knuckle down as well and wasn't distracted by these other outside influences, that actually I really started to get going. And I loved maths. I did pure and applied maths.
Interesting.
Yeah, I loved it. Absolutely loved it. I particularly loved the applied maths.
Really?
Trajectory of missiles and projectiles and, you know, velocities and all that kind of stuff. And I love physics, but I loved all that science and stuff. And I love, one of my passions in life is science fiction. So I'm very fascinated about the future. So that kind of, I really loved all that stuff.
Mm.
Hmm. And what did you, after leaving school, what was the first, did you have any career advice? Did you just know a CFO was a role that you would end?
No, actually, I decided rather curiously, because my father was a builder, but I didn't want to be a builder, but I was quite interested in construction, that I'd go and be a civil engineer. So I went to university to read civil engineering. And I did a 4-year degree in civil engineering. And it was only about towards the end of my second year that I went, not sure this is for me. I think I probably should have done a business degree. But by that stage, my take on university, it's really about the discipline of learning how to learn and applying yourself and learning how to learn, and also the friendships you make. You know, I don't think it necessarily matters where you go. I've met a lot of people from all walks of life that haven't gone to Oxbridge and haven't gone to the lowest higher education college. And a lot of people have done very, very well. And it's really, so it's about who you are as a person. I don't think necessarily rather than the institution you go to.
We are finding a lot of the interviews we're doing on this podcast, inevitably the person that we're speaking to is highly successful and had a very rocky either start in life or a very rocky educational, there was no clear checkbox. So we very much concur with you on that front. So when did the passion or an understanding of who you were as a person in as far as a professional role start to show itself?
Not until very much later on. And in fact, so I left university with a degree in first class honours degree in civil engineering, not wanting to be a civil engineer. And actually, I found it quite hard to get a job because I didn't want to be a civil engineer. And I hadn't done anything. And I went to a headhunter in London because I decided I wanted to train as an accountant.
Yes.
And I wanted to train as what's called a management accountant. So I trained in industry. I wasn't interested in audit. Right. That sounded very...
Okay, can we expand a little bit on what is the management accounting side then?
So management accounting is working in industry for a company dealing with some financial accounting, but much more about decision making and strategy ultimately, right? It's very much about analysis and decision making and what's going on in a business. Why are things happening? Yes. Why is the margin or anybody else? Rather than, the analogy that was often used when I was training was, instead of looking in a rear view mirror, looking at what's happened behind you, audit, you're looking out the screen, coming in.
Which is a whole different side of accounting. So, being an entrepreneur myself, I've never had an accountant that has even remotely tried to manage my business. Being an entrepreneur, that's something that I've always done myself. So is that the managing side of accounting? Is that the grassroots to becoming a CFO?
No, because I think the role of CFO is much understood. The role of CFO is, in my view, is somebody that has to be more than cocktail conversant in a spectrum of skills and knowledge elements within a finance function. So as CFO, I need to be able to know enough about audit to deal with the audit. I need to know enough about tax to review tax returns and deal with the tax advisors. I need to know enough about legal stuff to review contracts. I need to know enough about audit and audit processes. And I need to know enough about systems. I need to know enough about risk. I need to know enough about control. You've got to have a broad spectrum of skills and experiences to be an effective CFO because I'm not a world-class expert necessarily at any of those things, and I would employ people where I need to have the expert advice, but they need to advise me as CFO because ultimately the decision rests with me.
I think also, Ed, there is a mass amount of CFOs that hit a ceiling and they never, ever go beyond it. And I think that I think it was something I noticed about you was you seem to be able to articulate the vision of the entrepreneur into a numbers structure that will allow that growth to happen, which was hence, the mass, what we introduced was that extraordinary scaling. Very few CFOs ever, ever achieve that.
Storytelling is an important part of being a CFO, right? And the reality is a lot of people outside finance aren't very financially aware. And entrepreneurs, in my experience, generally aren't. They're much more focused on the business. What I mean by the business is, how does it sell? What's the product? What does it look like? What's the pricing? How do I interact with customers? How do I persuade them to buy my service or my product? How do I grow presence in the marketplace? They don't worry or necessarily interested. In fact, they don't really want it. It's something they don't really want to have is a legal function, a finance function, an IT function, because that detracts from scaling and growing their business, right? So my job really as part of the CFO in a founder led business is to be able to transcribe what's actually happening and make it pithy, short, accessible, actionable, so that the person who is leading the business or owns the business can go, right, I grasp that. I can see what you mean, what's happening. Yes. Right. What are the solutions? Because they all want solutions. They don't want issues. They just want you to come and say, here are the two possible solutions. Yes. I would recommend you could go for A or B or whatever it is. Right.
Yes.
Ed, how on earth did you manage such exponential growth in all segments of the company. You've got sales, you've got IT. I mean, IT alone is a whole different conversation. How did you manage to, and the finance department, how did you manage to bring those departments financially and articulate that message of what they needed to achieve and what needed to be hired? Because your role at that level surely is very integrated with the CEO, extremely so.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question, right? And the honest answer is it's not just down to one person. The critical thing, bar none, there's a couple of critical things. One, quality of leadership, right? And I very much ascribe to the be yourself, but with more skill, right? So authenticity of leadership. So being an authentic leader, leading by example, doing what you want others to do as well, right? So I think having the right quality leadership, hiring the right quality next level down, they've got the right levels of skills and experience that you need. And you need to pay for them, and you need to have an organization where they want to come and work for to help you solve them, because you can't solve all the problems yourself. It's very easy in a fast-growing organization to get into what I would call hero behavior, right? You start working harder and harder and harder to show that you can deliver stuff, but actually that's no good if you're getting exhausted and burnt out doing that, right? So it's really important to have a good team around you who you can trust, empower, delegate to get stuff done. And then it's about monitoring progress, setting a reasonable, achievable targets for change, right, in an organization. The reality is with a finance function, most of the time you have 1 week a month, broadly speaking, to affect real change, right, where people have capacity to do something. Because the rest of the time, most of the function is on a treadmill running a standardized process for a month-end close. Most organizations will be closing their books, so ready for financial information, working day 10 or something like that, maybe a bit longer. I mean, when I joined the company that I started at 120 million, I mean, they were into the following month to get the month reporting. So it was over a month late, right? We got that down to working day 3 to 5, just depending on what was happening. But that took several years, right? That took several years of really hard work. And that simple thing, disaggregating to solve that problem, there are many, 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 many issues underneath. Each of those needs to be thought about, tackled, identified. Sometimes might need a system enhancement. Sometimes might need a different person, change the process. You know, lots and lots and lots of factors would have contributed from going from 24, 5 days to close the books to 3 or 4, 5 days to close the books, right?
I totally, totally get that. But what immediately comes to my mind is here you are, not just your company or that company that you got to 2 billion, any company that you're scaling. You've more often than not, in a family business or privately run business like that, you're dealing with the entrepreneur and the chairman or the CEO. Tell me if I'm wrong, but by nature, I would imagine CFOs can be quite geeky, I would imagine, and number driven. So I'm just immediately thinking how that is the mark of a good CFO, when you have the bedside manner that can cope with an entrepreneur who actually doesn't really want to hear all the doom and gloom that you're going to do. I think you touched on it earlier when you said you've got to find solutions, but it is a bedside manner, isn't it, to work with everybody else?
Yes, I would agree with that. And there's also a massive element of trust, right? And trust isn't gained overnight. If I think about the founder CEO I last worked for, I would say it took about 18 months before we had a trusted working relationship. His previous CFO had been a very combative individual, and they'd been at loggerheads a lot of the time. And I remember very vividly when I joined and I decided to take the diametrically opposite approach my predecessor had. And he kept phoning me up going, what are you doing? What are you doing? You're telling him all about all this stuff. And I said, yeah, but he's the CEO and founder of his business. And my judgment is it's better to be open and transparent and honest and be really engaging with the individual rather than constantly going, no, you can't.
Exactly.
Yes, because then you'll get the exchange of knowledge and then you'll understand together how the vision can be enacted.
But I would imagine, sorry to interrupt there, I would imagine that is a real gift to have, mm-hmm. the brilliance of all that spectrum and the myriad of different sides of accountancy, if you like, that you have to be abreast of, but also to have the EQ and the bedside manner, if you like, to deal with bullish entrepreneurs.
And I would say that's evolved over a period of time. I mean, one of the big challenges working for an entrepreneur, and the really exciting bits, I think, is, well, not one, a couple of insights. One, their risk profile is very different to most people, right? So once you understand that, you understand, you know, they're quite happy to bet everything on black. And you're sitting there going, as a CFO, as a finance guy, going, oh my God, everything's going to go black. Well, that's just how they work, right? And they're backing themselves to make sure that that's a successful outcome. So that's an important thing. The other important thing is there's just a lot of ideas generated, right? Not all of them are good, and that's fine. My job as CFO, you know, for someone like that, is to decipher all, take all the ideas and go, right, those 10, that's rubbish, just forget about those because you won't remember them anyway. Those five are ones that, okay, they're worthy of consideration. And those three, right, we've actually just got to act on it because he's definitely going to come back around that. Yeah. You know, next class, where are we on that? Yeah. And I used to dread my old boss getting off a plane at a time when we didn't have Wi-Fi on a plane, which was a godsend, because as soon as we had Wi-Fi, it got even worse. And I literally, he'd get off the plane, just seeing flying to Ibiza, and there'd be 35 emails just coming, bang, 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 and I go, oh, right, I'm off the plane now. And, you know, and you'd have to, and each one of these emails had like a 15-minute read. So now you're in for a couple of hours going, right, because it's just like a stream of consciousness.
Yeah, it's also, I think it's, I would imagine that when you take a job like as a new CFO and you're working with a man like that, you know, you haven't got that much time to work the character out, have you? Really?
No.
In terms of years. You know, you haven't got 10 years to do it, have you? You've got sort of 18 months tops, a year tops.
Let me tell you a little war story. So week two of joining the company you outlined, Richard, we had a weekly executive call meeting. At this time, the business was in poor shape. And I was on the executive call meeting. I listened to everybody else chatting. I mean, I didn't really know anybody properly. And I mean, I've met a couple of them once, but apart from that, not really interacted with many of them, certainly not in a professional capacity on an executive meeting. And Robert said, he came to me last and he said, Ed, you've been here now 2 weeks, you've seen everything, you've probably figured out all the solutions. What's the most important thing we should focus on? And I said, right, well, I've been looking at AR, right? And 60% of our AR is overdue by more than 60 days to terms. Bear in mind, some of our clients were paying on 120 days, yeah. Right? So you're talking about 180 days before you would get the cash if everything was right. And everybody was stunned silent. And I said, back of a cigarette packet, I reckon we got 3 months of before we're out of cash. So we need to stop being very British about collecting. As we've got contracts,
yeah.
There's only three reasons why people don't pay. And I pointed those out. And that then led into a really important conversation about actually this was the critical lifeblood of the business. And what I would say, and particularly people listening, is right, sourcing out a business, working for an entrepreneur, it's not rocket science. You don't need an MBA, you don't need a PhD or anything like that. There are simple, immutable facts. Cash is king. It's a hackneyed expression, but it's absolutely true. Every time I've gone into a business, the first thing I've looked at is what's the cash flow? What's happening with cash? Have we got enough cash? What's the cash opportunity? The second thing is have I got the right people in the right space and the right function, you know, in the function? Is the function the right structure? Are we doing the things we need to be doing? The most important thing that finance does, bar none, in most organizations is payroll, right? And if you can't get that right, well, you're annoying an awful lot of people, right? So make sure you've got enough cash to fund the operations of the business and make sure the basic functions in finance are working effectively and efficiently and in a timely manner, right? So do you have the right structure and the right people? You know, once you start building off that, I mean, I worked on, when I joined this last business, I had five things I focused on only for the first 3 years. Cash, people, did we have the right people? And we didn't have, we had a lot of not the right people. But that takes time. You can't change it overnight. Systems, terrible finance systems, right? So that all had to change.
When you were taken on, what was two questions. What was actually your remit? And did your boss, chairman, CEO, whoever it was, did he realize the company was in up shit street without a paddle within 3 months in terms of cash?
My job was group CFO and to work with the executive team. But the role evolved. I mean, working for an entrepreneur, the one thing you have to understand about working for founders, entrepreneurs, right, is you as an individual have got to be completely comfortable with uncertainty and ambiguity, right? And change, because things change all the time within the day. I mean, the number of days I would go in with, like, I'm going to do A, B, and C, and I've ended up doing X, Y, Z, 1, 2, 3, 4, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, right? You know, just completely different. So if you're not comfortable with that, and with the CFO, that means juggling an awful lot of plates, right? So it's very difficult to say what was the job description, because for Robert's point of view, it was group CFO. Just that was an extensible, morphable thing. It just changed.
Yeah, but you couldn't have, your remit wasn't to get it to a $2 billion turnover in 7 years, was it?
No, and I'll tell you how that came about. Well, let me answer the other question, Richard. Robert absolutely knew what was happening in the business, and I was only told what one ninth of the business, the years long before I joined.
Which is why the old CFO went and why you got a chance, I assume.
Well, yeah, and also, you know, he's a salesman.
Right.
Yeah. Right. So he was projecting the virtues of the business. You know, nobody like, you know, an entrepreneur who it's his business. They all understand exactly what's going on in their business. So it would not be true to say that he didn't know what was going on. Of course, he knew what was going on, but he needed to persuade somebody like me to come and join and help him affect change in his business. And I'm very glad he did. I mean, I had an amazing time. Absolutely.
It's funny, isn't it? I'm sorry. I know Roz wants to ask a question. I'm really sorry, but I have to ask you this. It's funny because, yes, you say he absolutely did know what was going on. He knew it wasn't in great shape. But he also knew that you'd find out very quickly. So you could argue, well, you know, what's better? Just to give you the heads up before you come in, I suppose if you give you too much of a heads up, then you might not take the job at all.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, he might not have known because, I mean, there are different leaders, different entrepreneurs, and some are very good in finance. They understand forecasts and how to work. And others are just pure salesmen who are very good at being the front man. I want to ask you something, Ed, because this is the sort of glaringly obvious point. You know, we're talking about CFOs. There are CFOs, and then there are CFOs that have our ability to deal and think entrepreneurially and actually apply that financially as to how on earth you can get from A to B. Your A to B is extraordinary. That number, one, and the extended period of time, your 120 million to go to 2 billion in 7 years is absolutely extraordinary. And my head keeps thinking the same thing. How on earth did the infrastructure of the company not collapse? How did you manage that financially?
Well, how did you find all that new business for a start?
Right. So, well, I guess the story of getting to over 2 billion is really a three-stage story. Step one was turning the business around and making it effective and building a global platform. And that was about making most decisions correctly most of the time. I don't know if that came across quite well, but we as an executive team, we met every week. There was a lot of discourse. We debated everything. We acted quickly and decisively, and we got most of the decisions right most of the time, right? We didn't get everything right. Of course we didn't. Nobody does. And we were very careful about the investments we made in the business. We didn't want we were short on cash, so we couldn't invest too much. And that made us very careful. Every penny counted. That was a maxim we had, right? Every penny counted. It was critical to put in the right incentives in the business as well, because we needed to both reward people for the hard work they were putting in. And they hadn't been historically. You know, bonuses weren't paid because budgets were over-optimistic and they weren't set correctly. And then people didn't get rewarded. And then people got frustrated so they left, right? So it was a real step change, resetting of the expectations with the founder. Look, mate, you can have that budget if you want, but no one's going to achieve it. So what is the point? And by the way, we need to have a story that shows, projects growth, because if our end goal is to exit the business, we need to be able to have a good story around growth, right? And that isn't up, down, fail, missing budget. Yeah. That's about exceeding expectations over the medium term, right? So it took me a while to get that mental model inculcated, because the founder was very much, oh, I want to be 3 billion tomorrow, right? You know, that's just never going to happen. And it's also about setting the reward structures, the incentives in the business to get the right behaviors. So for example, one of the big problems about cash collection was it was falling on finance. Now, finance didn't interact with any of the clients. And so all you were going to have is our accounts receivable team talking to the client's accounts payable. And frankly, they weren't the decision maker anyway. So we set about changing the bonus structure. So a big part of senior people's bonuses was a measure of their overdues, right? The amount of cash they hadn't collected, right? And so, and we tightened that over years. And so everybody knew that if they were 20% of their bonus was based on have they hit a particular metric.
Bloody obvious when you look at it. It's obvious, but it's not, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Correct. But then you've got to have the system. But that's only part of it, right? I can set that. But they go, well, how are we measuring it, right? So you've got to have a system that records the data that everybody goes, yes, I'm happy with the quality of that data, and be able to produce a report to track it, right? So then you start going back through the process, and then you know you can see how that sort of disaggregates. And there are a number of different components that come to just for that decision, right? So we made lots of things like that across the whole of the organization. And to get a global business where you have entrepreneurial people, not entrepreneurs, but entrepreneurial people in senior roles, leadership roles, and get everybody aligned to go, that's the one way we're going to do this, is quite hard, because the guy running the Americas wants to do it his way, because gee, that's what we do in America. And the guy running Asia Pacific goes, no, we're not going to do it that way, we can do it this way. Go, guys, no, we need to do it all the same way. So you have to deal with all of that as well.
Ed, I just want to understand a little bit clearer. What I was wondering was, because if you're taking a company from 120 million, I understand the cleanup to get it actually healthy with the right on. I love the fact you mentioned entrepreneurs in the heads in the different countries. It makes such sense. I've always said hire entrepreneurs or future entrepreneurs. How did you financially message? How did you message with such a global footprint? And understand what each area, which country was doing what. How did you keep control of that? Were you meeting once a month online? How were you flying around? How were you dealing with that?
So part of the answer to that is hiring a high quality finance leadership team. So I had a finance leadership team of 7 people, which included 3. So I built a global finance function. I inherited 50 people when I joined the business. I ended up with significantly more than that when I stood down. But by the time we did the private equity deal, we had about 125 people in finance globally out of 1,300. And I had 3 regional finance leads. So one for Europe, one for Asia Pacific, one for the Americas. They were all responsible for their finance teams, soup to nuts, in their region. And I had a group head of tax. I had a group head of financial planning and reporting. And a Greek financial controller.
How many phones did you have, Ed?
I would have one-to-ones with them each week. Right. And then we'd have a weekly finance leadership team meeting, generally for an hour. And we would have an agenda. There'd be critical items need to be dealt
with. But you're right. It's the buck stops with you. So if that goes pear-shaped, it's on you, Ed. So how are you able to process that kind of information? Because I'm listening to you thinking, how does this man sleep? Suddenly. Did he sleep at the peak of all this prior to the sale? You know, I can't imagine you actually weren't working 7 days a week, correct?
Oh, yeah, but working for an entrepreneur is 7 days a week.
Exactly.
There's no rest.
Henry, well done. Sorry, I've just got to just say this and just take you back for a second. Have we actually talked about what this company actually did? Touched on that?
No.
Do you mind answering that? What was it?
Yeah, sure. It's what it does is it buys physical marketing material. Its core business is buying physical marketing materials on behalf of other organizations. So what you find is large global corporates have a purchasing function in-house, and they'll buy numbers of different categories of stuff they'll buy, one of which will be physical marketing materials, so anything printed, right? And what we do is we come along to what HH does, because I don't work there any longer, but it comes along and says, dear Mr. CPO, so Chief Procurement Officer, if you outsource your procurement function for buying physical marketing materials to us, we'll save you money. And we demonstrate how we're going to do that. And we'll do it better, faster, higher quality, in a more environmental way than you can do it today, with better information, so you don't actually know what you're buying. And that's what happened. And there are many industries that are are on an outsourcing curve. You know, some are more mature. So IT outsourcing is a very mature thing. Some elements of the marketing value chain are outsourced, and we're one of them. You know, so the physical execution, so the execution part of marketing, a lot of that is outsourced to third parties, right? Whether it's people fitting out stores or whether it's people like us providing, or HH providing the content that goes in stores or the content that might go in a branch or, you know, the signage in a retail store, whatever, or the boxes for watch luxury watches.
Really?
Oh, yeah, yeah. All that, you know, a lot of that stuff is, and HH has expanded service lines into creative and digital. So they've got 300 or 400 people that do a lot of creative work, digital work. So they won't do the big idea, but they'll follow on and doing the executional part of the creative element of getting a campaign out the door, right? If you're in retail or whatever it is, whatever that might be.
Ed, can I ask you something? Just flipping back slightly, is something in my head. Did you implement or HH implement an employee share scheme to retain? If you're talking about a company that is not cash rich and you're having to rely on incentives, what did you and what was the employee share scheme that was very effective?
What we did, Roz, is, well, when we did the private equity deal, we created what's called a phantom share scheme. So we had some people who were in various share ownership schemes, okay, right, prior to the private equity deal. And a lot of their value, well, a lot of people's value was rolled over into a new structure and everybody got the same shares. So we reset everybody. And that's one of the things, reasons why oftentimes it's a good thing to do a deal, because it's an opportunity to reset the who owns the business, right, and put in a new incentive structure. And then we had a number of there was a basket, well, there's a portion of equity that was set aside for what's called a management incentive plan. And that's very typical in private equity deals. And part of that's owned by individuals. And part of that is they have the right to the value of a share that's held on their behalf, right? Just depending on the particular structure. So we have a mixture of people who own equity in the business and people who have the right to a value of a bit of equity.
Okay? You, in your role, you must have to heavily understand tax. If you are operating at what is becoming a global footprint, how on earth did you deal in tax with so many different jurisdictions?
Well, you end up with a tax team, a significant tax team in-house and good tax advisors, because you're talking multi-jurisdictional, and some countries are very, very complicated. So India and Brazil, for example.
So where were you based? Where was the head office?
UK.
Okay.
What you find, a global business like HH, actually corporation tax is reasonably well run process, right? And well-documented rules, really easy to do. And the penalties for making a mistake are not that bad. The real difficulty is what was called indirect tax, or VAT type taxes, so sales related taxes. They're much more complicated to do, because generally they are specific in market. And if you take, say, the US, you would have thought the one thing they would have is a homogeneous approach to sales tax. Well, every state treats things in a different way. So actually, it starts to become really complicated to do products across the whole of the United States. I mean, the EU effectively has one set of tax rules. They're just different rates in different countries, right? But everyone's operating under the same framework, but just at slightly different rates. The US, very much more complicated. So it just depends which territories you're operating in. But the penalties and fines for making mistakes around indirect tax can be quite large. And of course, then you get this situation, just to add some real fun into the mix, where you can operate in territories where the tax rules are not necessarily observed in the way that we might observe them here in the West. And certain people like to extract value out of organizations by bringing nuisance cases against you, right?
That's very diplomatically put, which is why you're at the top of your game, because you've got your diplomat's hat on.
Can I ask you something? And I don't know if you'll be able to answer this, but what was the structure of the company? So if you had the head office in the UK, was it sales companies off it, or was it independent company? How was the structure that would allow the head office to remain autonomous?
Yeah, I was going to say king.
Yeah.
So in common with many international businesses, we had a euphemistically called Topco. Yeah. So you've got the ultimate top companies, right? And effectively, it's a bit like a Christmas tree from there on in. And depending on the jurisdiction, would be depending on the network of ownership. So it's not uncommon in Latin America and South America that you need two shareholders. So you might have, it's not uncommon in that place to have an entity in Spain and then an entity, say, in Ecuador, and the entity in Spain being a small shareholder in the entity at Ecuador or whatever it is, right? So there's some well-known things that you have to put in place. So you do end up with a sort of a network and a structure chart. Now, one of the challenges we faced was in the UK, actually, we didn't have enough legal entities. And what I mean by that is we had a legal entity when I joined where you had a lot of management cost and central cost, finance, IT, and then a lot of operational revenue and cost, right? And actually, it was difficult to assess the performance of the operational part compared to all the just the cost part. So we actually split the two out, right? So we actually deliberately formed a new separate legal entity. And why did we do that? So we could actually then start to charge that central cost out using a framework called transfer pricing, right? Which is perfectly permissible, and you start charging the cost out. You start charging things like the brand out, the value of the brand out to operating businesses. Because if you're not careful in a large global organization, if you don't start to do those kind of things, you could have, for example, you might have a lot of revenue and not enough cost in, say, your German business, because actually the management, regional management component is stuck in the UK, right? So actually, you've got a higher tax rate in Germany than you've got in the UK, and you've got more profits than you would like, but it shouldn't be there because they're not actually taking the cost for managing that business from a regional point of view or a global point of view. So you start setting up the business so that you can then recharge and move cost around within the prescribed global rules. So you don't have that. And that's why you often might see effective tax rates for large corporates. They'll publish what their effective tax rate is. And that's what they're doing, is they're moving their cost around to manage their overall tax exposure globally, right? That, and there's a good example, what I'm coming back to about being cocktail conversant. I needed to know enough about global transfer pricing rules to be able to sit and have a conversation with the corporate tax partner and my head of tax. Yes. Right?
Well, that leads me, I was going to say, and there's always at some point in when we're doing our podcast, it happens that, and I'm feeling I want to say it now, I just want to lighten it all up a little bit. But that is, I mean, God, I'm absolutely both riveted to everything you're saying. And I'm blown away with how you manage. But just to lighten it up, just taking you back to your other CFO jobs, and just to touch on what you said earlier, you said it was years of experience that I had under my belt before I could even entertain doing a job like that. So how many other CFO jobs did you have? What, four or five prior to that, in the years prior to that? Or
Two and a half. I mean, okay. Finance roles, right? Yeah. And then I had a big time out of finance because I went into consulting. So I kind of...
Did you?
I always felt a bit, when I went back into finance, I always felt initially a bit of a fraud. And by the way, imposter syndrome in CFOs is a real thing.
Oh, I can well believe it. So this company then, you joined this company and it's taking what, and it's, you know, 3 months off possibly from going belly up. Prior to that, did you know anything about tax laws globally or all these other systems that you've put into place? Or are you just learning on the job, are you? Because you're just bright and smart and...
No, but I mean, it's a bit like a maths problem, right? I know how to solve the problem, but just situationally, there's going to be nuances. I mean, you've got to really think about what the answer is going to be, right? So that's what I meant by having done the jobs before. I got to starting this last role confident that I could, I didn't think there were going to be many things I would look at and go, oh, crikey, I have absolutely no idea how to do that. And the reality is, although I'm the one making the decision, and this is what I meant by having a really good quality team around you, you know, with the finance leadership team of seven of us, we had things where we went, right, not sure how to do that. And I'd be very open with people, say, look, I don't know all the answers. Of course I don't, right? The whole point is, we're very smart people here. We talk about it. We can talk through the pros and cons. We'll figure out the answer together.
Ed, I think that the best environment is actually one where people are put under extreme pressure to find solutions. And I think that's often the entrepreneur's life. Entrepreneurs start companies. They don't know how to get from A to B necessarily. They've just got to learn extremely quickly. So I was listening to you talking and I'm thinking, you obviously clearly have an absolute love of your art and a passion for learning.
And solving problems.
Yeah, massive solving problems.
But this, that's what I see myself as.
I was going to say you, and also you've got the get. You know, you are a can-do person. I bet if your old CFO and your old boss was there, he'd say, "God, no, he's not a can-do. He said no to everything."
Possibly.
Ed, we've got about 5 to 10 minutes left, and we have a tradition that we ask three questions. So I'll ask my first question. It was something that I noticed you had said. You said that you liked Star Wars.
Yes.
Not that I don't like Star Wars, but it was unusual. It was unusual. What is it about Star Wars you liked so much?
I think he likes dressing up as Darth Vader. I thought we were going to see Princess Leia, which I'm...
I love the everyman story about it. I love the adventure. I love the escapism. I love the dynamic of the good versus the bad guys and striving for that. And I love the futurism of it. I think it's just brilliant. I think it's just a fantastic story. I think it's just brilliant.
Just admit this. Have you ever been to a Star Wars gathering?
Yeah. I went to Star Wars Celebration last year in London. And I've dressed up as a Jedi.
Your question.
My question. So it's always three questions. So Roz has asked one. The next question is, it's a difficult one, really, but everyone has such different answers. Your prime minister for the day, what is top of your list?
Easy. Reform Parliament. Reduce the number of MPs to 600 from 650. Legislate so you can be an MP until you're 40. Have really proper criteria about who can be an MP, because I think we've got so many people in there that are just not of the quality we need. You need people with real life experience. I've had to hire people, make difficult life decisions, tough business decisions. So I think you really need to improve the quality of the people we have in Parliament. You need proper adults in Parliament. You need people with integrity and respect, and we need to pay them properly. I would say between 250, 300 grand a year, easily, if not more, to get the brightest and best back into managing our country. That's what I would do.
I love that.
You know, we've done, 25 podcasts in the bag, and I don't think one person has said the same thing. That's pretty top of the list, I would say. That's very horribly intelligent answer.
Yes, it's brilliant. And process-driven.
The last question
last question, flying by the seat of my pants. You've done a lot with your life, Ed, and you've achieved much. What is the one thing you would or really hope for in the future for you?
I think just be able to continue to satisfy my intellectual curiosity.
Fantastic.
Interesting. Well, Edward Parsons, well, what can I say? We have absolutely loved this pod. I'm sure everybody's been, what a story, what an inspirational story. Yeah. I mean, I'm blown away with just the kind of mind you've got to have to
the kind
to
of mind run and go. You have.
Yeah, exactly.
You have a phenomenal mind.
Yeah, and what an incredible achievement. We have absolutely loved it. We've been so honoured that you've come on, and you have been so candid as well.
Yes,
which we really appreciate. Yeah. And I'm all sure all our viewers and listeners will appreciate that too. Edward Parsons, thank you so much for coming on. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you, Roz. Very kind. Really enjoyed it.
Another huge thanks to Edward Parsons, and an even bigger thanks to you for listening to this episode of V for Visionaries.
Wherever you're listening, we would love it if you could take a moment to subscribe and hit 5 stars, and we will see you in the next episode. Thank you.